Rise Up Radio. This is Rise Up Radio, Nottingham. Rise Up Radio.
Hi, I'm Elsa, and you're listening to Rise Up Radio.
Rise Up Radio.
RiseUpRadio.wordpress.com.
This is Rise Up Radio. This is Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio. Rise Up Radio.
Hello and welcome to July's edition of Rise Up Radio. This is Tin Man.
Morph.
Tina.
Susie.
May.
A kid. We're here in the backyard on a balmy evening in Wiverton Road. We've got lots coming up on this show, and we'll get straight into with Morph catching up with the Sumac Garden project that's been going on in the yard these last few months.
You've got lots of bits in there.
So, John, what are you doing?
I'm putting up some pots with new seeds. We've got lots of seeds and lots of compost. So, time to get planting.
Where do you get the compost from?
Some of it's been composted by Sumac Centre or food scraps. And some of it's municipal compost that I think has been got from the council at a very cheap price. But the only downside with that one is it's got bits of plastic and crap in it. So you have to sift through it a bit.
Where's the horrible stuff going?
I do it part time. It was doing, but then it isn't at the moment. So.
Do you want to put golden beetroot in yours? Because then it says maybe put something in that doesn't have a big thing in the middle.
Okay, so I'm going to do beetroot. Yeah. And we've got two more pots. What are you putting in yours, Peter?
This one.
What are you putting in it?
Oh, beetroot as well. All just right. The different varieties. Okay. Here. This is ready.
You would pull up in
here. Yeah.
have we got some dried mustard?
Got red ace, beetroot, golden beetroot.
We haven't planted any borage.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Has anyone ever eaten any borage?
Only the flowers. You don't need a lot.
But you're supposed to be able to eat
them. Yeah.
I wouldn't eat the leaves. They're all like...
rocket? Like, we haven't got any rocket in pots.
It's basically the cheapest supply.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's not some borage here, you know. Self-sown.
So it's just beetroot going in this pot, is it?
Beetroot in that one.
So how long will it take to get the beetroots out of that?
That's a good question. It says on the packet between June and November. So I guess it would be maybe September.
I was thinking, you know, okay. Something like
yeah. Alright, so what are the aims of the Sumac Garden Project then?
The aims is obviously to provide food, a bit of food, for the sumac centre. But more important than that is to be a resource for the local community. And encourage them to get growing their own stuff as well.
And what ways are you hoping to get people involved here?
Yeah, I think now there's...
Well, initially they can help out with the garden and learn stuff, you know, how it relates to their garden, because we've got similar plants. And if they don't know what to plant in their garden, we can go and give them advice. And also, if people know about gardening, they can come and tell us, you know, share their knowledge as well.
How did they find out about it?
Well, we're going to make some flyers. There's always been some flyers been made. And we're going to have a questionnaire, hopefully, if it gets off
very
the ground.
Organized on that one.
We're basically going to be going door to door, trying to gauge people's interest and see what they're using their gardens for at the moment. Yeah, so at the moment we've got a drop-in session every Tuesday between 5 and 8. People can come for the whole session or just part of it. See what's happening in the garden at the moment.
What can people do when they come and drop in?
Well, there's lots of jobs around the garden to help with.
Could people use the resources to sort of maybe start their own things off and then take them home afterwards?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. I mean, we've got a supply of planters that the council have thrown away. So hopefully we'll have to give them away and people can come make their own planters and then take them home. And also want some people to recycle pots, like DIY waste and or any sort of plastic container really. People come and recycle it. And we're also for seedlings, we can make little pots out of newspaper, which is just wrap paper around a wooden block and then push it into a cup, and that forms a little pot. And then you can take a little seedling home.
So Tuesday evenings?
Yeah, Friday's 11 till 5 as well.
Is there a website?
Not at the moment.
You just come along and check it out?
Yeah, but if people want to help with the website, that'd be great.
And what happens to the food once it's ready?
It's a share between the volunteers, and some will be used in the sumac kitchen. And we've got lots of herbs growing around the doorway that people who are cooking here can just like go and grab a handful.
Wow, that was Bond.
By Dawn Treader.
By Dawn Treader.
Local Nottingham artist.
Right, now we're going to play some discussions that we recorded earlier this week. We had a chat about some recent strike actions at the Lindsay Oil Refinery, which also had linked actions at Ratcliffe on Saw Power Station. Yeah, let's hear that audio now. So, we're just going to have a bit of a natter now about some of the strikes that have been happening, and maybe we should start with a little bit of background or on the stuff up at the Lindsay Oil Refinery, and that's been happening since the beginning of the year.
Lindsay Oil Refinery in North Lincolnshire has been sort of a big story this year. I think it was January or February now. There's a big walkout over the use of foreign labour and the conditions that the impact that was having on local labour. That people walked out there. There were then solidarity strikes across the country. Locally, Staythorpe in Newark, a lot of people walked out there. Also has had a lot of similar issues because they're at the moment building a new power station there. For every time, won their demands in a lot of senses. They were able to get new conditions agreed, came to an agreement with Total, who run Lindsay. Now, that kicked off again last week with Total, or subcontractors for Total, firing a lot of staff where there were still other subcontractors on the plant that were their building, were then hiring other staff at the same time, which was apparently contrary to the agreement they'd had. So people walked out there, and then there were big walkouts locally again in solidarity across the country. So
and is this with the same company, Total, or are there other companies, workers from other companies also striking solidarity?
The solidarity strikes are all sorts of things. So Sellafield in Cumbria went out, in January. Sellafield in Cumbria went out, gas power stations, coal-fired power stations, all sorts of big areas in sort of the construction industry. It was seemed to be industry-wide, beyond just targeting Total, in the sense it was part of a system that people were protesting against, the way that companies have been able to use, particularly European legislation, but globalisation generally, to bring in foreign workers under conditions from those countries, drive down the conditions and sort of rules for workers generally at the expense of everybody. So I say, what's striking about this is they won in the early strike earlier this year, and they appear to have today agreed to the conditions, the agreement to whatever Total have offered them. So they've actually won twice, illegal strikes outside the union bureaucracy, wildcat actions that seem to have been victorious in the sort of thing that isn't supposed to have happened anymore, that was supposed to have been killed off by factory in the 80s.
And it's probably up again now. What I was going to say is,
I think another thing that's interesting about this is the sense it fits into a general tendency that we've seen people occupying factories in over the Ford Vistian struggle that Anna was talking about earlier, which is something that never used to happen. We've seen wildcat strikes on a massive scale across the country. A general sense that people are picking up again in terms of industrial action. And this is actually something that's replicated elsewhere. So in France, you've started seeing this phenomenon of boss napping, with people basically taking their bosses hostage in order to get improved paying conditions, which is something you just can't imagine happening in this country. You also can't imagine the kind of French response to it, which is not to send in armed police as they might in this country, but actually to sort of treat it as a part of the negotiation process. It's almost accepted on that kind of level. Though this general, people, while we're being faced by the credit crunch and the recession, all these kind of buzzwords, actually people are starting to get together and organise, and aren't just sitting down and waiting for these supposedly these things that apparently we can't have any influence on, and we're reliant on the G20 or something to save the world for us. People aren't sitting around waiting for that. They're getting out there and getting organised and trying to mobilise to improve their own conditions.
And the stuff happening in France, and that's the police haven't really stepped in with the boss nappies and things like that. The response of the UK government is, in its public relations, is, would you say, fairly sympathetic? Are the police getting involved?
I haven't heard much of the police getting involved, because Bowman, these are all illegal strikes under sort of that trade union legislation. It does seem to be, there's a certain amount of, you know, playing the British jobs for British workers from Gordon Brown, so playing up the kind of nationalist aspect of it, whereas I think there is, on some level, whether they're conscious of it or not, a worry about sort of working class people organising themselves, so they're trying to play up the reactionary elements of it there, which are there. There's no denying that there are elements of that there, although I think what's going on is more complex. And the hope, I think, from the British state and the British ruling class, or whatever you want to call it, has been to try and play up those aspects, because that's what they understand and that they can control, and they can do well out of that. They can't, what they're worried about is workers getting together and organising, because that's going to hopefully, eventually, possibly, maybe sweep them away into the dustbin of history, the risk of sounding like an old Marxist.
So there is the mainstream discourse with these strikes being about the nationalist struggle, and you're suggesting that also the government latch onto those elements. Can you say a little bit more about that, sort of, if you've got any idea about whether the struggles is a nationalist struggle, or if it's about just simple workers' solidarity, or if there's actually too much happening to generalise about the activity?
I think I'd be risky about claiming, you know, from hundred or whatever miles it is to Lindsay of saying what's going on there, but you do get a sense that there's more going on. So if you read some of the stuff coming out from Lindsay itself, the strike committee involving members of the Socialist Party, and it's quite left-wing demands, you know, trade union organisation across the European Union, support for migrant labour, ensuring that there's translation, all this kind of stuff, which aren't straightforward racist demands at all. There's a lot more complex stuff going on. And in Plymouth or Portsmouth, somewhere beginning with P, there was a strike action there, and a large number of Polish workers who all walked out as well, bearing in mind Poland has various nationalist issues of its own, but also has a very strong tradition of labour struggle from the days of Solidarity. They came out in Solidarity. I think that's quite a powerful demonstration. It's much more complex than simply British jobs for British workers.
I'm confused with this particular issue on whose side I'm on when it comes to a three-sided argument. There's the workers' rights element, which I'm generally in favour of, because people do need to stick up to themselves against capital, and they need to look after their own interests, and withdrawal of labour and so on has been the only weapon available to the staff, and Thatcher's rules and laws at that time were considered to be unjust, and something should have been done to stick up for them. However, the other two equations in the situation is to do with British jobs for British workers, and we live in a wider world, and some of us are supporters of the No Borders principle, which means that shouldn't pertain. Really, people should compete on a level playing field, rather than think that they have to be all nationalist about it in one way or another. The third side of the argument is environmental matters. That these workers working in the energy industry, we know a number of people that have been protesting about their operations over time, whether it be Radcliffe on Soar Power Station, whether it be objecting to the King's North coal burning, whether it be objections to what's going on in Ireland with the Rossport pipeline, and there's similar equations on the north, on the Welsh coast at Milford Haven, or whether the northeast of England. Generally, I can think of a number of people who would be out there protesting and taking direct action on that issue. And yet there we are supporting the workers in their victory over multinational companies and trying to stick up for their own jobs. So with such a three-cornered argument, it is difficult to know whose side you're on. Perhaps it was initially brought to a few people's attention at the climate camp last year when Arthur Scargill turned out to put the case for coal mining, and a number of people present at the climate camp obviously objected to that notion. But it really is back to the old arguments of not being able to protest or to draw attention to climate issues without being accused of threatening people's jobs. And I think it's so important that when we're looking at these things that we're not trying to maintain the status quo. I personally am glad the coal industry fell apart as it did. The consequence for individual families and communities was horrendous because it wasn't managed correctly. Wouldn't it be nice if those people could be found something else to do? We're in that situation again now where major multinational industry is moving capital across borders to its maximum benefit with no care about local working conditions. And yet from the environmental front, whose side are we on here? What are we standing up for communities? Are we standing up for jobs in that instance? Or would we like to see social change that enables those workers to be involved in other activities? Basically, the thing is still looking through, being looked at through a lens of workers' rights, whereas there's these other dimensions that really need to be addressed, don't you think? An open question. Anybody? Can anybody clue me up? Because I'm confused and I don't know whose side I'm on.
Yeah, sorry, can you repeat that, what you just said?
Well, all of it or just that bit?
No.
The fact is that, I mean, the situation is about workers' rights. The multinational company was giving notice to a number of people that come from this country and giving preference to foreign workers, and that with the nationalists ideal then rears its head of British jobs for British workers. Well, is that what we as alternative thinkers think? I suspect not, and that we would be much happier if foreign workers weren't foreign at all, but they were human beings the same as the rest of us, and that the idea of no borders did pertain. But the third part of the triangle, as opposed to workers' rights and no borders, is environmental matters. And I don't know how we are supposed to stand up for workers' rights so that they maintain their job security in situations in which are environmentally damaging. With a three-cornered argument like that, with a couple of things I don't know anything about that are probably bolted onto the end of that, I'm finding it difficult in this particular instance to know whose side I'm on. Being confused as I am, I look for anybody to help me guide through the argument. But as it pertains at the moment, it cannot be that we're in favour of support for working conditions for people at the expense of wider concern for communities and culture come climate change. There must be some kind of change that doesn't affect. I mean, how do you involve people in those matters without threatening their jobs of work? It's always put that whenever people object to the way that we carry on with climate change issues, that we're imperiling people's jobs. Well, perhaps other things need doing, and we need social systems to enable those workers that would be impoverished by the laying off and doing those particular activities, that they need to be found something else to do. With that lacking, I don't know whose side I'm on.
I think there's a lot of valid points. I think one thing that Anna was saying was quite interesting, that a lot of the people in Ford Vistian, that a lot of people had never been involved in political action before, never been under, and they were suddenly, their eyes were opened and saw this sort of stuff, and they were going to read up on things and go to anarchist and lefty bookshops for the first time. And that's quite a powerful notion, the idea that when people are involved in struggle, they encounter things they would never otherwise have done, and perhaps change their ideas. The miners' strike, one of the stories I remember being told that I think is quite a powerful one, is that back in the day before the miners' strike, one of the NUM newsletters, I can never remember which one, I think it was somewhere up north, used to have essentially a page three. Miners would send in a picture of one of their wives with not many clothes on. This, you know, fairly common, this kind of chauvinistic idea that was quite common in a lot of those communities. And it was, I think, Scargo, or at least one of the other prominent members of the NUM, had come out quite supportive of this, you know, all these blooming lefty feminists, what do they know? And then the miners' strike came along, and the miners were out for something like a year. You know, they weren't having any revenue, so they were in need of money. They were, you know, it's a really difficult, long struggle. And what they found was that in that situation, the people who stuck with them and went out and basically collected money with the miners' wives. The And the women in those communities went out and did a huge amount of work. Wives Against Pit Closures was a hugely important campaign. And what they found was that then when those wives who'd moaned about this pictures, scantily clad pictures before, when they came along now and said, actually, we don't like these very much, they found they couldn't really refuse them anymore. These weren't just passive women sitting back home. They were people who'd been out there fighting with them on the, you know, at the centre of this struggle. And so that got pinned away. And I've heard similar stories about, obviously, homophobia. Quite common in a lot of these communities. They do, the communities from which miners come have often been, you know, a certain amount of homophobia and racism. And that's the unfortunate reality of those kind of communities as such as they were. But you found that these communities, that actually gay rights groups came out and supported them. So very quickly, their ideas on gay rights began to change. And the same thing, they would find that apparently Sikh groups and other ethnic minority communities would go out and collect loads of money for them and give money in solidarity to the strikers. And suddenly these people that before you thought were Pakis or, you know, Puffs or something like that, were suddenly the people who were supporting you while, you know, other white people were trying to screw you over, or in the case of the police, beat you up on the picket line. And people began to change their ideas through struggle. And I think, in my own experience, I found that what I think about stuff has changed by getting out there and meeting people and engaging in stuff. And I suspect that's a fairly common theme, that you get out there just for your own personal, because you want to earn more money or you want to protect your job in the first instance. But actually later on, you meet all these new people who come out and support you, and your ideas about the world start to change. And my hope would be, particularly if we engage with these kind of strikes, as I think we should, that we could help, you know, open those people's eyes to a different way of viewing the world. And hopefully, maybe they're not all going to become eco-activists tomorrow and go and lock themselves on outside, you know, Eon. But in the long run, that these people will begin to contribute something to the struggle for a better world.
You've reminded me of a set of circumstances that I had forgotten about for absolutely years up to now. The miners' strike was in 1984 into the early part of 1985. Major police actions, much distress, destruction of communities, loss of jobs, and so on. During that process, quite a few hippie travellers of the district went into the pit villages and maintained soup kitchens and stuff. That really there wasn't, in support of the miners' situation, and that was very definitely remembered because after the Battle of the Beanfield, which was later that year on the 1st of June 1985. My community was smashed by force of arms, and there was much destruction, and kids in care, and people under arrest. And on being released from custody, the camp that we initially set out from, we stayed on for a number of days to recuperate. And it was within inside of 24 or 36 hours that something like, it's edge of my memory now, but something like 10 or 15 white vans arrived from the pit villages in the north of England, carrying food and blankets to try and help support the raid that had taken place on my lot. And they had remembered the exchange of good works that was done from that community to those workers in Yorkshire and the County Durham especially. It's obvious that both identified the lack of their communities, and to this day I'm eternally grateful for their help, because we didn't get nothing from no one else there. Thank you very much. The fact remains that environmentalism at that time wasn't on the horizon, so we were just looking at the situation as a straightforward workers' community rights situation, such that if they lose their jobs, they lose their community, they all become impoverished and there's nothing else for them. And that is always the reason which, if you have an environmental argument with anybody involved in employment and capital, they will say, oh yeah, but I mean, really it's important what you're saying, but we really do need to hang on to these jobs. And the jobs underpin the communities. And so if we don't change our ways and we carry on business as usual, we can maintain our jobs and we can maintain our communities and everything's all right. Well, it's not now, is it? We have a different horizon, such that if we carry on as we are and we maintain people in their jobs and communities in the manner to which they've become accustomed, and we look at it through the traditional methods with which we have done in the past, we don't have anything to say about the kind of changes that we need to make for the future. And the recent union activity that we've been talking about here is largely within the transport and energy production fields, which are the two biggest targets for another bunch of people who we largely support here, in trying to bring attention to the fact that these people are committing acts that are going to lead to catastrophic climate change within the next few years. Not culpable as individuals, because we all just do our best, don't we? But as a system and as an outfit, they're responsible. How are we, for heaven's sake, going to take them on to say, we want to preserve your job, we want to do the best we can to preserve your way of life? And community is so important, it's one of the most important facets of human existence, community. However, if you carry on as you are and you keep digging up coal and you keep piping oil and so on, and you maintain your right to do that because otherwise it's going to cost you your job, we're all doomed. And we have to look at this through another lens in some way or other. So I support people standing up for their rights of employment. I think it's absolutely splendid that they should do so. Because there's, nobody should just act on their own. They should act as a community and look out for each other. But the consequence for not taking the environmental aspect to this is very bad. And it occurs to me we spend so much time protesting and conducting actions to try and bring about changes that these chaps seem determined to continue to be responsible for. I don't know. I'm lost.
The classic argument in that respect tends to be the sword to ploughshares argument, in that you need to turn your industries and your skills and your abilities to something more useful or creative. Anna was talking about when she first went down to Forbisti and she thought that they were going to start making wind turbines. Now, that turned out not to be true, but that is the classic way in which the debate is phrased, and it comes from looking at munitions factories after the war. Obviously, there was suddenly a much less demand for munitions, so they look at turning those factories into making something that they did need, which was medical equipment in that instance. And that, I think, is going to be the route you're going to have to go down. I think if they've shown anything, it's workers at Lindsay, you don't want to mess with them. They're strong, they're well organised, and they will take you on if you need you. These are people that we need on side. And so the only way around that is going to be to engage in a dialogue and each to build the other, because they're excellent at standing up for themselves and they have a whole newfound authority that's come through quite a well-built and actually quite a well-organised shop stewards network. Now, that is something that if you engage with it, you can utilise and each side can build the other, but you're not going to succeed in opposition to them.
No, I mean, I think what we're trying to do is to find mechanisms by which they can be brought on board, so to speak. I quite agree. Swords to ploughshares is about the best argument. How do you get there? Is it by union action? Do you think the unions have any kind of policy when it comes to redistribution of tasks and jobs as opposed to wealth, which we all know about? Is it the companies themselves? They'll shift depending on what they see as capital and what makes a buck. It has to be government.
Straight off the bat.
Is it governments? Governments might like to paint us a different priority in how people manage themselves. And I don't see any of those actions taking place. It'd be so nice to think individuals saw the benefits of redistributing their work, but they need leadership and guidance from somebody. And if it's not the unions and it's not the companies, the government appear largely disinterested in all of this, saying it's nothing to do with us, and the individuals are disempowered by carrying on themselves, except in small ways, by going into small business trying to bang together wind turbines or small systems of different sorts, which aren't good enough to solve the situation that we find. But I take on board what you say, that the people do feel empowered by the fact that they have beaten the master here in this respect, like, and called them to account. And that should give people individual power to think to the next stage. But I wonder if it ever will, because people, once they get disposed to thinking that they've got the job for a bit longer, they can support their families and they can support their children and they can pay the mortgage a bit longer, they're still beholden to the man. And there doesn't ever seem to be that bit left over for people to think how we might change otherwise without it costing their job. But it's required kit now to have that into the equation, isn't it? We just wish there was a bit more leadership from on high. Even though they accept the enormity of the situation, as soon as anybody does anything about it, they're told they can't do that here. And that needs to change. Urgently.
I feel that we're coming towards a conclusion here. We're all in agreement. I think the key thing, the most useful thing that we can take from this, that I would take from this, is that on two occasions, people got together and organised themselves and took on the people they considered to be the enemy, and they won. As it says, I think I was reading a post on Indian media, direct action gets the goods. You know, you can fight, take people on, and collectively, and you can win. You can win against very powerful multinational companies backed up to some extent by the state and the European Union. And you can take those people on and you can win. And I think we should take some inspiration from that, if nothing else comes out of this.
Room for hope, except we don't know win what. The other way this could have gone is that the multinational companies would have got their way. They would have employed to the lowest rate. They would have cared little about health and safety. And they would have just got their way by treading on people. And nobody thinks that's what I'm arguing for. But there are the other dimensions in the argument that weren't there the last time we were talking about trade union matters, which was a good 20 years ago now. And some of this stuff is going round again, but there are these other two equations, the larger economic community and the fact that you could think you can hire people at a cheaper rate elsewhere while bringing their health and safety matters from the local country that they come from, which are going to be cheaper than what we as expecting higher standards of work and labour. And the environmental matters, which do mean that there is no job security after they've won the right to produce goods and services from the domestic labour, because in the next 20 or 30 years wars will be fought over water, things will be getting an awful lot hotter, farming won't look like it does here, transport cannot be guaranteed. Economic collapse is likely to follow as some result of some of these matters, and the unions don't have anything to say about any of that I've heard so far. We all make it up as we go along, don't we? But we would like to think that there might be a little more guidance, in that people do need to work to maintain their communities and their labour, but we'd like them to work for something that is more productive than something that is potentially more destructive in quite a short period of time.
Okay, thanks for that, Tash. So lots of questions raised there, and we're obviously not going to get around to answering them all, because we don't necessarily have the answers at the moment, but it's good to...
We're looking into it.
Yeah, it's it's good to start looking into these matters. Have you got anything else to add, Lydia, before we wrap up?
Not off the top of my head.
No. Yeah. I hope you've got something out of this discussion. Leave your comments in the comments form at the bottom of the page, and we look forward to more discussions.
Yeah. This next song's it's a travelling song. It was written about the travelling community in the 50s. When things changed drastically for them, like the child change and the industrialisation of agriculture and all that sessional work that used to come up, seasonal work and stuff. And then the laws that made people move on all the time and they weren't welcome anywhere. And just the industrialisation of the nation and how it affected the travelling people across the country. And it's called 30 Foot Trailer. Just...
The old ways are changing, you cannot deny. The day of the travellers over. Nowhere to go when there's nowhere to buy. So farewell to the life of a rover. And farewell to the cat and the travelling Tom. Farewell to the Romany token. Buying and selling the old fortune, telling the knock on the door and the hawking. And farewell to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. And farewell to the 30-foot trailer. You've got to move fast to keep up with the times. For these days a man cannot gander. There's a bylaw to say you must be on your way, and another to say you can't wander. And farewell to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. And farewell to the 30-foot trailer. Of heather and broom, farewell to the creel and the basket. For the folks of today, they would far rather pay for a thing that's been made out of plastic. And farewell to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the trailer, the travelling man. And farewell to the 30-foot trailer. Farewell to the pony, cob and the mare, for the reins and the harness are idle. Don't need a strap when you're breaking up scrap. So farewell to the bit and the bridle. So farewell to the fields where we sweated and toiled at, pulling and shoving and lifting. Soon our machines and those travelling queens and menfolk had better be shifting. And farewell to the tent and the old caravan, to the tinker, the gypsy, the travelling man. And farewell to the 30-foot train.
This one's a bit more cheery. It's about the beggars in Nottingham. You've seen them about, a bunch of rascals.
Well, I will drink and swear and curse, and try to steal somebody's purse when it's wet and windy. The coppers come and pick me up on a weird some Wednesday. Well, I just couldn't give a fuck when it's wet and windy. I hope the God is looking down on a weird some Wednesday and tries to help me score some ground when it's wet and windy. emotions seem right. I'm away at some Wednesday, away from 50 quid on a packet of lights. When it's wet, I'm with you. On Wednesday, oh, you'd be blue if he was you. When it's wet, I'm windy. I tried to play it straight one time. I think it was a Monday. It nearly drove me out my mind. I got over it by Sunday. Drinking on the street got changed by the gentry. We've got to keep it more discreet, or it puts them off their brandy. So I will drink and swear and curse on a way to sun Wednesday and try to steal somebody. And it's wet, I'm windy.
Yes, nice one.
That was James Tully, recorded at the Rhizome Housing Co-op fundraiser. This is the new co-op in Nottingham. You can contact them on Rhizome Housing Co-op at riseup.net. If you don't know what a rhizome is, you should look it up on Wikipedia. And now for Pumping with Andrew Martin. It's a new regular cycle feature.
I saw someone cycling up all the way up Mansfield Road on one wheel today. He looked very determined.
Yeah?
Yeah.
But it was probably a unicyclist.
No, he had a bicycle.
Bicyclist.
A bicycle.
Right.
Any top cycling tips for the month of July?
Oh, let's have a top tip. Inflate your tyres to the full pressure. It makes cycling so much easier.
And any good routes to try at this time of year?
Fruits and roots. Cycling routes.
Yeah, I was thinking along them lines.
Okay. I would recommend going out to Shipley Park, go along the Route 67, Sustrans route from Ilkeston. You can get that quite easily from Sumac. You go up to Strelley, through the Housen Estate, and then through Strelley Village, over the M1 on the Bridleway, out to Ilkeston, and then traffic-free path to Shipley Park.
And what do you find when you get to Shipley, or was that a surprise?
Oh, it's a surprise, but I can give you a bit of a temptation. You cycle past a lake that is in the space of what used to be the open cast coal mine, and until a couple of years ago used to be the American Adventure, and the American Adventure has ended. The lake's still there, the buildings have gone, and there's plenty of cycle routes around the park. It's worth mentioning that some of the current non-landscaped area of the park is going to be re-designated as a coal mine, and security people in yellow tabards are always around, just in case that some people might turn up on bikes with, how should we put it, thoughts in their mind that don't tally with the objectives of the country park.
Still nice things to see at the park, apart from sort of coal holes?
Coal holes. Yeah, there's a landscaped area, much like Rushcliffe Country Park down near Ruddington. So it's reclaimed land from probably 20 years ago. landscape lawn area. Lots of big open space so you can fly your kites and ride your bikes. There's a cafe there. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the top cycling tips. Any groups for people to get in touch with if they fancy joining? Are there any bike rides happening?
Yeah, I recommend. There's the local Nottingham Cycling Campaign group called Pedals. Website is www.pedals.org.uk. There's also Rural Rides, as in rural countryside, and that's on the Notts County Council website. On Sunday, a few days ago, was the Great Notts Bike Ride, and that's always worth mentioning because it gets people out on their bikes. And then there's Critical Mass, which is the last Friday of every month, and it starts in Nottingham City Centre at 5 o'clock in the Market Square.
All right.
So yeah, if anybody wants any more advice, they can get in touch with me, Andrew, at Sumac Centre, by whatever means you feel appropriate.
Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Okay, pleasure. I'll speak again.
All right, nice one.
Cheers.
Cool. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, off the cuff. Yeah, that's one.
Was a clip of Guillaume's new track called Sirius Star, out now on Burke and Soul Records. Next, Tin Man went to find out about a food co-op operating in Lenton and Dunkirk.
So I'm here with Michael in the
Dunkirk Community Centre.
Dunkirk Community Centre, and it's Wednesday about 1 o'clock, and every week I understand you're selling bags of vegetables. Is that right?
That's correct. Every Wednesday at the Lenton and Dunkirk Community Centre, we actually sell bags of fruit and veg for £3.
Brilliant. And so how does the scheme work? Is it the same fruit and veg each week? Or
no. So what we try and do, under the government's legislation, you know, where people actually are supposed to get five a day.
Right.
Yeah. So what we try and do, we order five items of fruit and or veg And every week, you see, we actually alternate one of the items, so therefore people don't get the same every week.
Okay.
And again, for the same price of £3. Some weeks we do actually overspend.
Right.
But again, because of that, like, sorry, because we're a non-profit making organisation, we still charge £3.
Okay, brilliant. Looks like you might have a customer.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Lovely. Here, mate.
All right, just one bag, please.
Lovely. This one. What, oh, you all the same?
Did you want to get another bag?
I'll get
another bag. Sorry,
I've
got £3. There
we go. Lovely. £3? Lovely. You're not getting free, you're that band's end, isn't you?
It's got a little
bit. Yeah, it's done. So how long's the scheme been running for?
Well, to my understanding, there was a review back in 2006, which involves the Blacken man of the ethnic communities looking at the length and Irish flags and the food available to elderly people.
Right.
Now, obviously, from that, they formed some kind of forum, wherein later on they started the Small Steps Food Project, and I believe. For Lenton, that's been running for just over a year. Dunkirk, under maybe 6 months.
Okay, right.
So it doesn't mean that long. But again, for me, it's like, well, nothing. No, I came in, I took up a project that was already up and running. So again, no, my role is to like, no, try and develop it where we get more people producing their own local food so we can actually either sell it on or bring more people to buy our goods.
So you would be potentially interested if anyone was producing a large amount of food in Nottingham, you would maybe be looking to buy it off
definitely
them?
Definitely to buy.
Okay.
Again, as long as we can get it to a decent price, so we can, again, sell under our scheme of £3 per bag.
Okay, brilliant. And how would someone get in touch with you if they wanted to?
They could get in touch with me at the Dunkirk and Lenton Partnership Centre. Sorry, Partnership Forum. The number would be Nottingham 0115 941 9525, or you can email me at fw@dunkirkandlenton.co.uk. Dunkirk and Lenton is Dunkirk AND is an and, Lenton all one word.
Brilliant, and we'll put those details up on our website as well. And other than offering their food for sale, how can other people get involved with the project?
Well, we desperately need volunteers for the Dunkirk Centre.
Okay.
Like, apparently, like at present, there's only two people, myself and Richard. So basically, like anyone out there who's willing to free some spare time on a Wednesday between 12 and 2, helping us in the bag and sell the produce itself would be greatly appreciated.
Brilliant. And again, they should just get in touch with you. And
just get in touch.
That's just 2 hours a week.
2 hours a week. Every Wednesday, 12 till 2.
Great stuff.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
Cheers then, Michael.
Well, it's a pleasure meeting you.
Silver sky, I'm so high, no, that's a lie. I'm digging through the bowels of our foundations. Save me from these muted suffocations. I might be quiet, but don't be shy. Reaching out through the silver sky, reaching out through the silver sky. Memories of a summer's morn, whispered words in a simple form. You gathered up my cosmos, you fed it to me as one. Oh, you're laughing, dancing, naked figure, silhouetted by the sun. Nothing's ever left me torn like memories of a summer's morn. Memories of a summer's morn. The river flows into the sea, everything that needs to be. There's no longer that sure-faced person I saw in myself. When I spent my time speaking factories dressed like somebody else. The young catch up with their ancestry where the river flows into the sea. The river flows into the sea. Oh. chick from Panama. I tell her the last time I cried was long ago. Drinking in a Seville bar, watching flamenco. Truth is flimsy and it stretches far when you're playing blues on an old guitar. Playing blues on an old guitar. Incense burning on my window frame. My best laid plans all smell the same. The streetlight sets the scene, the smoke from a chimney flies. To an Italian family saying grace with tears in their eyes. I'll stick around, recite your name. Incense burning on a window frame. Incense burning on a window frame. Thank you.
Okay.
And that was Harvey Bruce and the Easy Listening, again from the Rhizome Housing Co-op fundraiser at the Sumac last week. That's all from Rise Up Radio for July.